Chapter 8. Having made up my mind to forget what had happened, I passed the next 7 days in comparative tranquillity. By the end of the week, I grew so firm in my footing that I hardly noticed the pitch and roll of the ship, nor minded the ever-present damp. During the same time, the weather held. No storms came our way. Though days were not always bright and clear, we ran before a steady wind that graced our helm and ruffled our hair. With every sail bent, we were making good progress, or so Captain Jaggery assured me. In my ignorance, I even stood above the figurehead in hopes of seeing land. Naturally, all I saw was an empty, unchanging, and boundless sea. One day seemed much like another. At the end of the morning watch, sometime toward 6 bells, I would wake. Now I had been taught that, at the start of each day, I should present myself as a proper young gentlewoman to my parents, or, when at school, to the headmistress. On shipboard, it was only natural that the captain should be the one I wished to please. But it must be said that preparing to appear on deck was not easy. My day began with a search, usually successful, for fleas. Afterward came a brushing of my hair for a full 20 minutes. I did the same at night. Finally, I parted it carefully, wanting it smoothly drawn. Anything to keep it from its natural and, to me, obnoxious wildness. Then I dressed. Unfortunately, my starched clothing had gone everlastingly limp and became increasingly soiled. Hardly a button remained in place. Though I tried not to touch anything, those white gloves of mine had turned the color of slate. So dirty did I become that I resolved that one of my 4 dresses would be saved, neat and clean, for my disembarkation in Providence. It was a great comfort to me to know I would not shame my family. If I wanted to wash things, and I did try, I had to do it myself, something I'd never been required to do before. Moreover, to do washing on ship meant hauling a bucket of seawater up to the deck. Fortunately, the captain was willing to order the men to lift the water for me on demand. Breakfast was set out in steerage, at the mate's mess. Served by Zachariah, it consisted of badly watered coffee and hard bread with a dab of molasses, though as days passed, the molasses grew foul. Dinner at midday was the same. Supper was boiled salted meats, rice, beans, and again bad coffee. Twice a week we might have duff, the seaman's delight, boiled flour and raisins. In the evenings I retired to my room to write the particulars of the day in my journal, after which I walked out to gaze at the stars. So many, many stars. And then to bed. Sundays were remarkable only in that religious observances were briefly held. The captain kindly allowed me to read a biblical passage to the men before he offered reminders of their duty to ship and God. Sundays were also the one day of the week on which the men shaved, if at all, and washed their clothes. Sometimes. With no chores to perform, I spent the bulk of my day in idleness. I could wander at will from galley to forecastle deck, mate's mess to wheel, but, try as I might not to show it, I was sorely bored. It should be no surprise that the high point of my day was tea with the captain. It was a cherished reminder of the world as I knew it. He always showed interest in what I had to say, in particular my observations of the crew. So flattered was I by his attentions that I took pains to search for things to tell him, and then prattled away. Unfortunately, tea lasted only from 1 bell to the next, a mere 30 minutes. Too soon I had to return to the less congenial world of the crew. I did take care, at first, to keep my distance from them, believing it not proper for me to mingle. My one friendly gesture was to read uplifting selections to them from my books. As the days wore on, however, it was increasingly difficult to refrain from some degree of intimacy. I could not help it. I've always been social by nature. In any case, I concluded that I was simply doing what the captain had suggested. In fact, kept urging. That is, keeping a lookout for any act or word that hinted of criticism or hostility. Though I desired to make it clear that the crew and I were on different levels, I found myself spending more and more time in their company. In truth, I had endless questions to ask as to what this was and what was that. They, in turn, found in me a naive but eager recipient for their answers. Then there were their yarns. I hardly knew nor cared which were true and which were not. Tales of castaways on Pacific atolls never failed to move me. Solemn accounts of angels and ghosts appearing miraculously in the rigging were, by turns, thrilling and terrifying. I learned the men's language, their ways, their dreams. Above all, I cherished the notion that my contact with the crew improved them. As to what it did to me, I hardly guessed. At first standoffish and suspicious, the crew began to accept me. I actually became something of a ship's boy, increasingly willing and able to run their minor errands. Of course, there were places on the Seahawk where I did not venture. Though I returned several times to my trunk and was not frightened again, I forbore exploring the hold. Barlow's words and my experience were sufficient to scare me off. The other place I shunned was the crew's quarters, the forecastle area before the mast. That I understood to be off limits. But as I grew more comfortable, as the crew grew more comfortable with me, I mingled more often with them on deck. In time, I even tried my hand and climbed, granted neither very high nor very far, into the rigging. As might be expected, I fastened particular attentions upon Zachariah. He had the most time to spend with me, and had sought to be kind, of course, from the beginning. Being black, he was the butt of much cruel humor, which aroused my sympathy. At the same time, despite the crew's verbal abuse, he was a great favorite, reputed to be a fine cook. Indeed, his good opinion of me gained me, in the crew's world, the license to be liked. Zachariah was the eldest of the crew, and his life had been naught but sailing. When young, he had shipped as a common sailor, and he swore he'd been able to climb from deck to truck, top of the mainmast, in 20 seconds. But all in all, as he himself freely told me, he was much the worse for his labor, and therefore grateful for his cook's position, which had paid better than a common tar. For he was aging rapidly, and though he claimed no more than 50 years of age, I thought him much older. He had saved nothing of his wages. His knowledge, as far as I could tell, was limited to ship and sea. He knew not how to read, nor to write more than his mark. He knew little of true Christian religion. Indeed, as he confessed, he was much distressed as to the state of his soul, and took comfort, as did others, in my reading aloud from the Bible, which they believed had the power to compel truth. In particular, it was the story of Jonah that had a hold on them. Since Zachariah never mentioned the dirk, nor again spoke discourteously of the captain, I took it as an indication that he knew I would not condone such talk. This meant that our conversations were increasingly free and easy. It was he, more than anyone else, who encouraged me to engage with the crew.
"Miss Doyle has been kind to me," he said to me one morning. "But if she's to go scampering about, she'll need, for modesty and safety's sake, something better than skirts."
So saying, he presented me with a pair of canvas trousers and blouse, a kind of miniature of what the crew wore, garments he himself had made. While I thanked him kindly, in fact I took the gift as a warning that I had been forgetting my station, I told him, rather stiffly, I fear, that I thought it not proper for me, a girl, a lady, to wear such apparel. But, so as not to offend too deeply, I took the blouse and trousers to my cabin. Later on, I admit, I tried the garments on,
finding them surprisingly comfortable until, shocked, I remembered myself. Hurriedly, I took them off, resolving not to stoop so low again. I resolved more. I determined to keep to my quarters, and then and there spent 2 hours composing an essay in my blank book on the subject of proper behavior for young women. When I emerged for tea with Captain Jaggery, I begged permission to read him some of what I had written. So unstinting was he in his praise that I gained a double pleasure, for in his commendation I was certain I had won my father's approval too, so much were their characters alike. The captain spent his days in punctilious attention to the ship, pacing off the quarter-deck from wheel to rail, from rail to wheel, ever alert to some disorder to correct. If his eyes were not upon the sails, they were upon the ropes and spars. If not upon those, they rested on the decking. It was just as he had warned me. The crew was prone to laxness. But, since he had the responsibility of the ship, not they, he was forced, with constant surveillance and commands, to bring discipline to their work. Things I never would have thought important, he could find at grievous fault. From tarnish upon a rail to limp sails and ragged spars, whether it was rigging to be overhauled or new tar to be applied, blocks, tackle, shrouds, each and all were forever in want of repair. Decks had to be holystoned, caulked, and scrubbed anew. The bow scraped and scraped again, the figurehead repainted. In short, under his keen eye, everything was kept in perfect order. For this, all hands would be called sometimes, more than twice a watch. I heard the calls even at night. Indeed, so mindful was the captain's sense of responsibility toward the ship, my father's firm, as he was wont to remind me, that no man on watch was ever allowed to do nothing, but was kept at work. "You are not paid to be idle," the captain often declared, and he, setting an example, was never slack in his duty. Even at our teas he was vigilant, again so like my father, and patiently examined me as to what I had seen, heard, or even thought, always ready with quick and wise correction. He was not so patient with the first and second mates, to whom he gave all his orders, depending upon whose watch it was. These men, Mr. Hollybrass and Mr. Keach, were as different from the captain as from each other. Mr. Keach, when summoned, would scuttle quickly to his side, nervous, agitated, that look of fear forever about him, and absorb the captain's barked orders with a cringing servility. Mr. Hollybrass, the first mate, would approach slowly, seeming to take his own silent soundings about the captain's demands. He might lift his shaggy eyebrows as if to object, but I never heard him actually contradict the captain in words. Indeed, the captain would only repeat his commands, and then Mr. Hollybrass would obey. "Have Mr. Dillingham redo the futtock shrouds," he'd say, or, "Get Mr. Foley to set the fore gaff topsail proper," or again, "Have Mr. Morgan set that main clew garnet to rights." The men of the crew, hardly finished with one task, would have to set about another, though they did so with dark looks and not so silent oaths. The captain, gentleman that he was, appeared to take no notice. But more than once I watched him call upon Mr. Hollybrass, or less often Mr. Keach, to punish a man for some slackness or slowness I could not detect. If provoked sufficiently, the captain might resort to a push or a slap with his own open hand. And, much to my surprise, I saw him strike Morgan, a short, stocky, squinty-eyed monkey of a man, with a belaying pin, one of the heavy wood dowels used to secure a rigging rope to the pin-rail. In dismay, I averted my eyes. The fellow was tardy about reefing a sail, the captain said, and went on to catalogue further likely threats. Confinement in the brig, salary docking, no meals, lashings, duckings in the cold sea, or even keel-hauling, which, as I learned, meant pulling a man from one side of the ship to the other, underwater. "Miss Doyle," he might say when we took our daily tea, You see them for yourself. Are they not the dirtiest, laziest dogs?
Yes, sir, I'd reply softly, though I felt increasingly uncomfortable because I could sense resentment growing among the crew.
And was ever a Christian more provoked than I?
No, sir.
Now, he would always ask, what have you observed?
Dutifully, I would report everything I'd seen and heard, the dodges from work, the clenched fists, the muttered oaths of defiance that I had tried hard not to hear. When I'd done, he always said the same.
Before we hove home, Miss Doyle, I shall break them to my will, each and every one.
One afternoon the wind ceased, and for days after the Seahawk was becalmed. It was like nothing I'd ever experienced. Not only did the breeze vanish and the heat rise, but the sea lay like something dead. Air became thick, positively wringing wet, searing to the lungs. Fleas and roaches seemed to crawl out from every timber. The ship, festering in her own malodorous breath, moaned and groaned. 5 times during those days, Captain Jaggery ordered the jollyboats lowered. With Mr. Hollybrass in command of one, Mr. Keach the other, they towed the Seahawk in search of wind. It was useless. No wind was to be found. Then the captain, abruptly accepting the ship's windless fate, set the men to work harder than ever, as though the doldrums had been prearranged in order that he might refit and burnish the Seahawk as though new made.
Sweet are the uses of adversity, he instructed me.
The complaints of the crew grew louder. The oaths became, by perceptible degrees, darker yet. When I reported all this to the captain, he frowned and shook his head.
No one ranks for creative genius like a sailor shirking work.
The crew is tired, I murmured, trying to suggest in a hesitant, vague way that even I could see that the men were fatigued and in need of rest.
Miss Doyle, he said with a sudden, hard laugh, even while urging a second sweet biscuit upon me, you have my word. They shall wake up when we run into storm.
How right he was. But the storm was, at first, man-made.
This ends Disc 2.